since 1971.
Tuesday night, it's coming a week from tomorrow night, actually. Riff invites you to have some fun at the Rooster Tail on a riffraff cruise. We'll be broadcasting in the Riff Yellow Wagon.
The home of rock and roll throughout the 70s and into the 80s.
Hi, everybody. I'm Ken Calvert.
And I'm Lynn Waterson.
Join us tomorrow as we rock the Motor City bigger than all Texas, the Thursday edition of the Riff Rock and Roll Morning Show.
Detroit's only real rock and roll radio station in the decade of the 90s.
Yeah, what time is
it? 5:01 almost.
Is it really?
Yes.
Oh, no.
Yeah, you don't have time to go back to bed this time.
Oh, God damn.
For nearly 50 years, we are, have been, and continue to be 101 WRIF.
Ooh, you have a remarkable mouth.
WRIF is a remarkable radio station.
Baby!
Well, welcome to the podcast. This is the history of WRIF. I am your host, Mike Staff, and I had the pleasure of being a DJ on the Riff from 1992 to 2006. And we're taking a look at the people and the personalities that, well, that made the Riff the Riff.
Well,
and,
I guess, to some extent, I would, I guess.
I don't know if there's a person with more personality on WRIF than Ken Calvert.
Well, it depends upon who you ask. Now, I know that Arthur preceded me, right?
Sure, he is.
No, I think Arthur was the big personality. He was the. I'm not so sure he was the. He was the straw that stirred the drink. Mm-hmm. That'd be the best way I could describe it. And I like expressions like that. But Arthur was without a doubt the most interesting character I have ever been around. Day, night, on air, off air, any situation, the most interesting human I have ever dealt with. He was the man of 1,000 moods, and all of them were just, he had the capability of having the greatest amount of artistic peak I think that I've ever witnessed.
How so?
Anger. You know, I remember saying to him, "How you doing?" "Well, obviously not so good." "Well, no, I didn't know that you weren't doing so good." "Well, then why'd you ask?" "Well, I'm sorry. Why don't you settle down?" "Well, then why don't you start asking stupid questions?" I was like, it came from nowhere,
right?
But I truly enjoyed it.
Well, and there's part jest in there with him, and there's part not, and sometimes you're unsure of which you're getting.
Yeah, I remember walking into the studio once, and he was singing the song, "I don't want to grow up. I'm a Toys R Us kid. Lots and lots and lots of toys that I can play with. I want to be a Toys R Us kid."
I can see it being a theme song.
And I was just
art.
Like, wow. The gentler side of Arthur Penhall. But no, that was, I love him. I absolutely love him. And I think it's a crying shame that he's not on the radio right now.
Mm-hmm.
But I will say this, and he'll be pissed off to hear me say this, but I think it's only because he simply doesn't want to. But selfishly, he should. I mean, he still owes it to a group, a generation, and another generation that never had the opportunity to hear that kind of radio. Right. You're in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. You're an iconic jock. There aren't enough... I don't think there's enough of Arthur's material out there. I really don't. Mm-hmm. Because we couldn't do it like we can do it now.
Well, that's true.
And just think of all of the stuff we lost.
Well, I imagine he probably has some of it on reel-to-reel tape and things like that.
Yeah,
and
but just what do you think? Where do you think that went?
Right, where? Who
went,
knows?
Right back into a production room because, you know, the production director would always need more tape.
Right.
Then he would go, "Well, nobody marked it. I'm taking it." You know what I mean? And then we had the DATs, but nobody really.
Right.
There was no caretaker of the DAT.
Right.
Occasionally a cassette. You would put a cassette in and record the interview, but I don't remember what I did with them.
And I often think about that now because if I were still on the air now and I did an interview, I would just post the interview on Facebook,
yep.
And then I know it's there forever.
Yeah, that's a great idea.
And all the pictures of the interviews and all that kind of stuff would never get lost.
I remember in 1973, that was the first year I was in radio. I remember Don Schuster telling me, the PD at the time, and not a long period of time, and well, I don't mean to just ramble on you like this, but the first person I ever interviewed was Ken Hensley with Uriah Heep. And I just thought, I'm not ready for this. Uriah Heep. You know, easy feeling, you know. And I done the rancher's daughter.
You know what I mean?
And stealing. And I just remember going, okay, breathe deep. Okay, breathe deep. What are you going to ask him? How you doing? Just start with how you doing. Or, hey, man, how you doing? There you go. Hey, man, how you? You know, and it was just, I would give my kingdom to have that because it was
that
my first.
That one interview, right.
It was my first interview.
Yeah. And little did you know that that was the prelude to all those other great interviews.
People
with so many
say,
people.
What was your favorite interview or who did you interview? And I remember my wife looking at me when we were watching Bohemian Rhapsody and she said, did you ever meet Freddie Mercury? And I said, I did. And I said, it was so weird because the entire band came in completely dressed for stage.
To the radio station.
To the radio station because they were going right from the radio station down to Cobo.
Mm.
And I was like, and Freddie was not a friendly person, very eccentric, very arrogant. Deacon was very cool. Brian May was the source point for me. And I just remember them walking out going, that was weird, you know.
And of course, when this stuff is going on, you can't really put it in the context that we have it right now.
No, and I also can't refer to it because I never even thought to put any sort of recording device or tap that red button that would have allowed that because the record guy just said, we've got 15 minutes, we've got the time, let's just stop by and say hi to Ken Calvert. Mm-hmm. He's on the air from 6 till 10. And it was like, well, okay. So, but that's the saddest part of my career is that I don't have all of that somewhere. If I had it somewhere, I wouldn't mind because sure. I would eventually get to it, but I don't.
Yeah, it's gone.
But it's gone.
Yep. So, yeah. It's in the ether.
Somewhere. Yes. Yeah. That's what they call it. That's where it is.
So, Ken, you have had such an unbelievable career in Detroit. I mean, your voice is one of the most recognizable voices of Detroit. It's personifies Detroit.
Does it?
It really does. When did you know you had this voice?
I didn't know I had a voice. I really didn't. I knew I had a passion for it as a young kid. I remember my dad worked for AC Spark Plug, and he went to car dealers, and he went to gas stations, and he sold spark plugs. And if they bought enough boxes of spark plugs, AC spark plugs, they got tchotchkes. And one of the more popular ones was a small transistor radio. And I remember I got a lot of amp transistor radios. You know, I mean, as gifts, and I knew, but it was great. Mm-hmm. So at night, like so many kids did and maybe still do, I time traveled at night. And these transistors at night, you know, would go into Cleveland, Chicago, Pittsburgh. They would go down south to the 50,000 clear watt radio stations, CKLW at night. And JR went
of course,
everywhere. So I'd be listening to Tiger Baseball. And it was just, I would time travel and I just loved rock and roll. And I loved what these guys were doing. So, you know, it was groovy guys, groovy gals. And they were talking so quick and so seamless. And my dad did have a great voice. So my dad did say, articulate, pronunciate, say your words correctly. You'll do better in school if you talk like you're, if you know what you're talking about. Mm-hmm. And I was like, oh, okay. And so that's essentially, I mean, that's, and then all of a sudden I realized, no, this is what I want to do.
So you knew when you were a little kid.
I knew officially in the ninth grade that I wanted to be on the radio as a career.
Got it. That's great, isn't it? A gift.
I mean,
you don't realize what a gift that is at the
15,
time.
At 15, 16, I knew this is what I wanted to do. You know, I had a few things that I knew would probably, to the point, where if I got drafted, and I was convinced I would get drafted, that was going to be my mission in the service, was to go into radio. And I thought, I've got to figure out how to explain what type of radio I want to get into. Right. So I don't want the one on my back where I go in first going, there's tons of them. Get here quick. You know what I mean?
So were you waiting for your next step in life? Like, I don't know if I should go to college, if I'm going to be drafted.
I thought I should go to college because my buddies were in college and they were having a great time in college. But I hadn't really effectively pursued it the way I should have. So I ended up getting into a college in Grand Rapids called Aquinas College. And I wasn't prepared for college, but they had a radio station. And I went and I auditioned for the radio station. It was a daytimer. And during the day, they did classical music. And at night, they opened it up. It was so limited in terms of jocks that nobody was going to get in. It was really, uh-uh. But they had to give you a little bit of an interview. So I got an interview. And I didn't get the gig. So I only stayed for a semester, came back home, went to OCC, got a gig at WORB, Orchard Ridge Broadcasting, where I worked in the mornings. I had a two-hour morning show, 2 days a week, with a woman by the name of Randy Stember. We had to share time. Randy Stember changed her name to Randy Thomas. She got a job at W4. She and I became very good friends. She was very attractive. They hired her. She told the guys there, the guy you should be talking to is this guy I worked with at WORB, OCC. His name is Ken Calvert. Hmm. And so they said, well, fine. Thank you so much. But Randy, I want to tell you, as a sidebar to that, Randy Thomas is the voice of the Academy Awards.
Oh, really?
The Emmys, the Tonys, the ESPYs, you name it. When you hear that female voice, they did a big piece on her this year because of the fact that it was the hostless Academy Awards. She was basically the host as the announcer.
Interesting.
Our presenters tonight are so-and-so, so-and-so. And so on, so so-and-so. This is, you know, Mike Staff, first nomination and first award, first time winning an Academy Award for the Ken Calvert interview.
Isn't that something? And she'd been doing it for so long, and that was
how did he get into radio? And so I check in with her every once in a while, but she really made it big.
Isn't that interesting? We all have somebody in our lives that kind of
helped open. Two people at OCC... One got to a big-time radio station, mentioned my name. My name got me an interview. My interview got me a, hey, life lesson. Go back, learn how to do this, come back. And I can finish that part of the story real quick if you want.
Sure.
She did get me an interview. I did go down. I met a guy named Don Schuster. Schuster and I went to lunch. We stopped at a chicken shack on East Jefferson. And I will tell you, I was terrified. He said, stay in the car, I'll go get the chicken. And I was not in a comfortable area. And it was very, very hot and very, very curious at the time. Just sort of like sitting in the car going, how long are you going to be inside? And he finally came back out. We went to Belle Isle, where he pulled out two joints. We opened the chicken. We did a little toking and talking, and I started talking about Keener 13, started talking about CKLW, started talking about Keener FM, we started talking about, at that point, WRIF, and we just had one of the most incredible talks ever. We were just two guys talking about loving radio.
Now, was he the PD at W4 at that
time?
He
was the PD. And I believe he was the temporary PD because KZEW had just gone on the air. Not switched formats in Dallas. Had just gone on the air. And his air staff was raided. Ira Cook, Mark Daddy Addy, a guy by the name of Ken Rundle, three full-timers gone, and there was one other. So they were just completely hammered for talent, and they had hired a guy by the name of Paul Sullivan, a guy by the name of Jim Pettijohn. They changed his name to Jim Jefferson. They hired Randy Thomas, and they had a guy by the name of Michael Benner and Karen Savelli. So we had a great, great lunch. Came back, and he said, you got to do the I-75 shuffle. You've got it. Get up north. Come on. And I said, what's that? He goes, start your way down I-75, go up to Traverse City, then come down to Bay City, Saginaw, Flint, then stay in touch, bro. Stay in touch. I said, okay. So they had a guy that did all nights, Brent Wilson. I get home. I've never been so happy in my life. Emotionally exhausted. Phone rings. My roommate answers the phone. Hey, it's a guy by the name of Don Schuster. He wants to talk to you. I said, yo, Don. What's up? He said, hey, my all-night guy just took a big dump on me, man. He's not coming in. Is there any way I can put you on the air overnight?
Full-time.
To fill in.
Okay.
The whole show. Don't go to bed. Don't go to sleep. Don't nap. Put on a pot of coffee. Get down here in the next 2 hours. I got down there. I waited around. I waited around. I waited around. Didn't go on the air till I believe the shift started at midnight and went to like 6 a.m. Midnight to 2 was arguably the worst radio in the history of mankind.
Your first 2 hours ever.
I knew they were that bad that I'd never see him again. 2 to 3, a little smoother. He kind of came in and went, yeah. 3 to 4, hey. 4 to 5, he was like, I think this guy's getting it. And by the time 5 to 6 came, I was so whacked, I just didn't care. And he said, excellent, bravo, bravo, nice job. He called me the next day and said, my big boss wants to see you tomorrow morning. I think it's good. The guy's name is Bart Walsh. He said, I'll pay you $750 a month to do 2 to 6 in the afternoon.
Wow.
With a Saturday shift of 10 to 3. And I went, where do I sign?
Coming up.
Anyway, my job was to say, Thin Lizzy, love this record. Boys are back in town. We're going to play the shit out of this. But I got to tell you right now, this is not me authoring this. This kind of comes from management. I got to have you make your next stage down to sales, because we're going to have to back this up with revenue and ads.
The History of WRAF podcast is brought to you by the Spex Howard School of Media Arts.
BackstageCountry.com, your online home for all things country music. It's going to be a busy year for country superstar Jason Aldean. He's extended his Highway Desperado tour and is teaming up with Kid Rock for Rock the Country tour dates. We've ranked our top 5 Jason Aldean music videos. Text Jason to 45911 to see if your favorite made the list on BackstageCountry.com. Text Jason to 45911 and we'll send the link straight to your phone.
The History of WRIF.
JJ.
And the Morning Crew.
Ken Calvin.
Arthur Penhallow.
Steve Costan.
And Karen Savelli.
Legendary personalities from Detroit's iconic WRIF. With Mike Staff and our special guest, Ken Calvert.
So how did you become PD? You didn't have experience.
Well, that was by default. It was because I actually, to some extent, had some experience, and Bob Birch was the PD. He was a guy out of St. Louis. The Grafman brothers, eventually the owners of Century Broadcasting, decided they were going to pull this thing in a little bit, make it a little more like Casey in St. Louis.
A little bit tighter format.
It had a format. I wouldn't say a tighter format. It actually was time for a format. In other words, when I worked at ABX at one point, you could go from playing Whitey on the Moon by the Last Poets to a spoken word record by Ken Nordine. If any of the other FM stations played it in any sort of a rotation, ABX would not play it. Okay? When it got to a point when Shelley Grafman, one of the owners, but a hands-on, hardcore, essentially a PD, operations manager as we know it now. He wanted to hear bands that were successful in St. Louis. If it worked there, it was going to work here. His way in St. Louis was going to work here, and to some extent, it did. So he also liked to draw revenue from the record companies by adding their records, enter Ken Calvert, make him the music director, make him the MDPD, because Birch, at that point, they were starting to accumulate properties, Camel in San Francisco, other stations, one in Los Angeles, and Bob Birch became a big player in the industry. He was one of the big guys. I stayed back. I would see the record guys, men and women. Women were at the forefront of the record industry back then. They were really the power players. It's very interesting. They were ahead of the time. They were way ahead of the curve. Denise Monsell, Millie Felch, trying to think of who else. They'll come to me. Anyway, my job was to say, Thin Lizzy, love this record. Boys are back in town. We're going to play the shit out of this. But I got to tell you right now, this is not me authoring this. This kind of comes from management. I got to have you make your next stage down to sales, because we're going to have to back this up with revenue and ads.
So the record company would buy ads.
Record company. If you want your record to be supported properly.
Interesting.
This is not a demand. This is the two of us working in concert to promote something that we truly believe in. Well, I was very uncomfortable. I was very uncomfortable with it because I wasn't on the capitalistic side of things at all. It just was not in my DNA.
Yeah.
So it was an interesting time. My relationship with the record companies got me a couple of interviews with the record companies. The record companies said, hey, we like the way you roll in your gig. Would you be interested in working with us?
And so you went to Columbia Records.
I ended up going to Columbia Records. Started with Epic, and then I moved over to Columbia.
Okay. Now, was that tough for you? Because you had a pretty good radio gig.
I loved it, and it was a good gig. Because I was one of those guys. Now I needed to know. You know, I was one of those guys that when you got the watch for Christmas, I took it apart instead of wearing it, okay? Now I wanted to know how the record company fit in there, okay? And I knew that, you know, you were the guy carrying tickets. You were the guy bringing artists in. And I did that for 3 years, and only 3 years. But it felt like 10, and what it did to me emotionally and physically is really hard to explain.
Did you have to move?
I did. I moved to Chicago, which I loved. And then one day, I got a phone call from Jim Johnson, and I was kind of burning out. I was out on the road with the New Barbarians, Ron Wood, Keith Richards, Stanley Clark, Zigaboo, Bobby Keys, and it was like the Rolling Stones without Mick. And, of course, all the radio stations would tease Pittsburgh is the one market that Mick may show up. Cleveland was for sure the market. Mm-hmm. No, it's going to be Detroit. And I was the guy that would come in and make sure that Costan, O'Leary, Johnson, everybody else got their tickets, got their meet and greets. But I was the guy actually with the band. And I remember being with Woody and Keith, close to Woody and Keith, true story, Lake Geneva, Wisconsin, where they were based out of. They had an airstrip there. And would fly out of there, fly back, and they had like these sprawling townhouses, and they all had bicycles, and we all had a place. And the amount of drugs and alcohol was beyond anything, to the point where I was really starting to get concerned.
Yeah.
And I said, "Whoa, I got off that tour when it left the Midwest, and I got back to Chicago." And I just said, "Whoa, I got to cool it, man. I'm
Now, you worked closely with Bruce Springsteen, too.
I did, and that was a blast.
That's a different scene.
That was
scene
in 78. Oh, that
he
was
wasn't
much,
doing drugs.
No, that was
that
a much different scene. But that didn't mean the radio guys weren't. And with Columbia Records, we had a, we called it the khaki policy. Columbia guys wore khakis. The Epic guys wore blue jeans. We kind of were more the GQ type guys. The Epic guys had a way of using their American Express cards, company cards. They could work in concert with a bartender, give him 10% for $90. They'd use the card for a $10 drink and get $90 back.
Got it.
Okay. The 90 would get you what you needed to get to take care of PDs, who I'm not going to name, all around the Midwest.
Now, this is way different than, so our listeners understand, not payola.
No.
We're talking
this was
a little bit different.
This was purely entertainment to assist the PDs and the MDs, just to make sure that the show was perhaps just a little brighter and they were a little happier.
A little bit more alert.
Yeah. And it was, and I'll tell you what, it was a don't ask, don't tell. Mm-hmm. It truly was.
Because it was practice too at the time.
Absolutely. It was, it could not be mandated, but it was, there were ways of burying in your expense account, and everybody did it because everybody had to do it. There was a station in Cleveland that I won't mention that you had to bring something or you did not get a meeting. There were so many other stations, Country Western, nothing like that. Country Western wanted to, you know, because that was part of your, if as I was a RAPM, a regional album promotion marketing manager.
So not just rock.
I also worked with the country guys and the R&B guys. And the country guys just wanted to go to 2.5 hour lunches and get drunk. They just wanted to pound some beakers. R&B guys wanted to have lunch and a long lunch at a really good restaurant. You know what I mean? Maybe have a little scotch, a little cabassier, whatnot. At the scotch and sirloin over, you know.
And the rock guys was way different.
Yeah, the rock guys, no, the rock guys didn't care about eating. No, the rock guys just wanted to, you know, light them up and light it up. And so, but anyway, to end that epic, and then I'll get out of the way. To end that, to get to Riff, in late 1978, 79, Jim Johnson, it was 79. It was July of 79. I was ready to come home. Johnson called me from nowhere and said, "Hey, we got a thing going on here. We're putting the band back together at WRIF. It's me and George in the morning. It's Arthur in the afternoon. Karen's doing evenings. Jay Brando's doing middays, and I think they're going to move him somewhere, maybe all night, and Phil Foreman. I don't know what they're going to do, but they're making some moves, and I put your name in for it. So, Calvert, you have to move home." And I went, "I have a job, Jim." He goes, "Then quit and come home, Calvert. You can't pass this up. This is too good." I started thinking, well, I am back home. I'm back on the radio. It's middays at Riff, WRIF. He said, "Yep." So I went to Steve. "You've got to get a tape." So I went to Steve Dahl's house. Dahl had a studio. And I cut a tape, and it was pretty brutal. But I sent it off.
It had been a few years.
Yeah, I had to get it off. And Bender got it, and Bender said, "This is horrible. But, you know, but I got something." And I didn't even know Bender very well. And he said, "I got to tell you, the GM, Jay Hoker, has never heard of you." I said, "I don't know what to tell you." He goes, "Well, come on in and meet him." Three of us went to dinner at the Holiday Inn at 10 Mile and Northwestern.
You, Tom Bender, and Jay Hoker.
And Jay Hoker, yep. It's now a Kirby's Coney Island over there. And we went to lunch and came out of there. And Hoker said, "Well, I'll have Tom get back to you. I'm going to let Tom handle this. I'm cool. He says this to Tom. And Tom says, "Well, I'll get back to you." So I met with Tom again, and Tom just said, "Is your heart in it? Do I got you?" I mean, he was really like, "Is your heart in this?
That makes sense.
Are you going to go off on me again? You know, are you going to do anything? I mean, You've been at W4, you've been at ABX, you've been with a record company in a very short period of time, and that's only been 6 years. What, I got to have you. I said, you got me. I'm home. This is it. I can tell. And late 1979. Wow, wait a minute. What is that? Is that, 30 years ago?
40 years ago.
Oh, you should.
79, 20, yeah, 40 years ago.
Ugh. 40 years ago today.
So that lineup, you know, so you have JJ and the morning crew in the morning.
JJ and the morning
crew. You're
in
middays, Arthur P. in the afternoon, and Karen Savelli at night. To me, I know it's not the air aces of the ABX days, but to me, that was like
the first riff heyday.
Yeah. The beginning to riff really being on the
map.
That's
when the chemistry across the dial was seamless. Everybody just sounded awesome.
And everyone was lit up to be on this radio station that was kicking ass.
You could not. I mean, it was, there was no higher power than to, you know, God, we were putting 3,000 people at Oak Park. I remember playing Journey once, and it was just.
Journey in a softball game.
In a softball game. It was wall to wall. And it was just phenomenal.
So you have JJ and the morning crew, and they, would you say that they hit their stride at Riff during that time? I mean, they were bubbling under at W4.
Mm-hmm. They were bubbling under. I remember Dahl at ABX because Shelley Grafman hated him. He said, I'm not going to have a guy on the air eating cereal, crunching it on the microphone, and talking about how badly he wants to get laid. And his number, and I said, people are loving it, Shelley.
Right.
And he says, well, I'm not. You got to get rid of him. I said, I can't get rid of him. I said, he's a friend of mine. We live together, man. I said, I can't get rid of him. And he said, well, you're going to have to. I said, well, I can't. Find somebody else to get rid of him because I can't. And he did. And I said, but I want you to know, Shelley, I've never pushed back on you in my life. You're making a mistake.
Yeah, and our listeners in Detroit may not know Steve Dahl, but he is about as big as it comes in Chicago.
He ended up in Chicago. And don't forget, it was just the anniversary.
A blowing up disco?
Yeah. It's the anniversary 2 weeks ago.
Yeah.
I guess. Well, no, it was in 79. It was 40 years ago.
Mm-hmm. It's 40 years ago. Yeah.
Because I had just started at Riff. Yeah.
So JJ, what was it about JJ that finally hit? Like, because they had a huge following in Detroit.
Because
they were the kings.
When Dahl went to Chicago to the Loop in Chicago, I think he just slightly offered George a position. He didn't say, George, you're going.
Steve.
And, yeah.
Steve offered George.
Yeah, Steve Dahl. I'm not even sure that he offered him the gig. But I knew George wasn't going. I mean, he was not going. Johnson was a PD. Johnson had to fill in. I remember seeing Johnson, and he would say, I don't know what I'm going to do. I said, you guys sound pretty damn good together. Why do you want to do anything? Because I'm the PD. I said, well, can you do both? Yeah. I said, well, you can leave early, man.
Right.
What do you have to do? Station's running itself. Why don't you just become, people are getting used to you doing it. And so he said, yeah. And it morphed. He didn't take my advice. I took a lot of people's advice. But it morphed into a great show.
Yeah, it did.
And that's when Riff said, that they got something going there. We're going to get those guys. And that's when they really started to put together a radio station. Bender really wanted to put that thing together. He had Michael Collins on in the morning before that. And it was a wayward radio station. They just didn't know what they wanted to do, but they wanted to be a player in the FM music industry, and in Detroit especially.
Well, and when they put that team together, that was like a statement that says, here we are.
It was get out of the way. Mm-hmm. And we had that beloved time in the trailers where it was just hysterical, which even brought everybody together even more. On a day like today with no air conditioning, opening up windows in an actual trailer.
Well, yeah, sort of let the listeners in on the joke. ABC Radio owned Riff at the time.
Yes.
And almost like the bastard stepchild, kind of, because rock radio really wasn't a thing. It was just becoming a thing, right?
Well, it was, but it wasn't. I mean, you had PLJ in New York. And I know for sure PLJ. I know that when I was working there, we had to hit news at the top of the hour.
On Riff.
Yeah, and you had to back time because it was live.
Right.
I dug that. I thought that goes back to my transistor radio days,
right,
man. That was cool.
And
you got this
math.
You got a 10-second ding in your ear, and you were like on the map going, when I get back, I've got that new one from Bob Seger for you. But first, this. I'm Larry Wall, ABC News.
Like, but get back to the trailer real quick.
Yeah.
Riff Studios were literally
in
a trailer.
Two trailers side by side.
A double wide.
Double wide.
Uh-huh.
It was a double wide. And if anybody ran down the hall, you would hear boom, 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 boom. And it would literally go over the mic. And when we'd open this back window to get some air into the studio, you would hear the cars going by on 10 Mile Road. And guys would be cutting the lawn, and you'd have to go, Tom, what am I supposed to do? They're really close to the trailer. Play one more. You know, because they'd be right at the door, at the back window.
So then, how soon after JJ and the morning crew were on Riff did you come on? Was it like pretty much back to back, boom, boom?
Oh, I would say it was, I don't know the exact timeline, but I'd say it was within months. Within months.
Yeah, and then Arthur already had a following, right? And
Arthur did.
Reputation.
Arthur did, yeah, because Arthur was the voice of the radio station. I believe he was he probably would tell you he was the first live hire.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah?
Yeah.
I think so.
Yeah, before, when it was WXYZ FM.
Yeah, and then they did that full page ad. But yeah, Arthur went from Cicero Grimes in Ann Arbor to...
Right.
I think he was living out in Holly or something. And he was doing afternoons. And he felt much better when he had a support staff around him.
Mm-hmm.
And he liked me. And I liked him. We were fire and ice. You know what I mean? Because I kind of poked the bear. And I like to poke the bear, but I know that he liked to be flattered.
Mm.
And that's when I started coming up with stupid stuff to do. I gave him the name the Grand Poobah.
Yeah. Well, and the Friday afternoon crossovers were just absolutely legendary.
Ladies and gentlemen, the staff and management have assembled here in the hallways at WRIF, all looking down. As you may know, Arthur refuses to make eye contact with the working bees. This time he... Nearly nude Samoan manservants will slowly work their way out to the 1963 Econoline van, which says on the back, if I'm reading it correctly, don't laugh, your daughter may be inside. And on the other side it says, if this van's a rockin', do not come a knockin'.
It was the just consummate theater of the mind, which is what was so cool about radio. Now, how much prep did you put into this stuff, Ken?
Or
was it just kind of like...
I started on Thursday nights to write up things like, this man was once seen wearing aluminum clown shoes to a mini skirt contest. And... He would kind of laugh.
Oh, he would.
And he
laugh.
Would just, he would preen. He would walk around the studio like, qua, qua. And then we'd go into Jeff's Boogie. The great Jeff Beck instrumental, mm-hmm. Yardbirds instrumental. And then we were just off and rocking. And I remember one time just taking the Bob Lowe boat horn, that brrrr, and we came up with Rock and Roll Overtime.
Yeah.
And it made more sense for his show. I just remember it made more sense for his show.
Yeah, the rock and roll overtone, it's a lot of our listeners will remember that.
Yeah.
He would use it in the context of its
82
riff rock and roll overtone.
Because it was twice. It would go once, and there was a gap. It was like, 82 rock and roll riff, roll over, take off your top, baby, rock. You know. And then he started coming up. Then he started doing rhymes that made no sense.
Right.
You know, and then he'd lose his place in trying to create a rhyme. It was just like, if you can't do it, then don't try and underdo it.
The history of WRIF.
It's quitting time!
coming up.
And I'll never, ever forget the time Costand blew it. Tell you what he did. He started to play I Love Rock and Roll. And just that, da-da-da-da-da-da-da. And then he went to spots. Guy called and said, nope, you did not fulfill the promise. $5,000. Five in a row, or we pay the dough. Stevie hit the wrong button. But we had promised to play a song from start to finish, five in a row, with no interruptions.
BackstageCountry.com, your online home for all things country music. Like most of us, Keith Urban also has a bucket list. You may be surprised to learn what is and is not on his. Text Keith to 45911 to read and learn more about the central theme of Keith's bucket list. Get a link to the story sent right to your phone when you text Keith to 45911. Go inside country music at BackstageCountry.com.
101. The history of WRIF.
WRIF.
Everything that rocks. With Mike Staff and our special guest, Ken Calvert.
Those were, without a doubt, the most incredibly great days. We ended up moving to the new building, which was just so... It was so shocking to the system to go from two trailers side by each, which I wish we never had. Because the room just, it just gave it so much, there was so much DNA in that room. You know, that when we
probably
went into...
Probably for real.
Exactly. Oh, yeah. When we went into that, Oh, you bet. I mean, a squirrel got loose in that, got in there once. Poor Karen. I think poor Karen hated it, though. I don't think anybody's been happier than Karen.
Talk about Karen for a minute. She really had a following. She really resonated with the rock and roll
audience.
Well,
of course, because she fulfilled the ultimate promise. You know, what does Karen look like?
Right.
Really good.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it wasn't like you were being...
fooled.
It wasn't like you were being
voice.
A pig.
Right.
You know what I mean? It was like... And it was only natural for guys. It was theater of the mind.
Uh-huh.
I remember Michael Benner, who I worked with at W4, and I always laugh about the fact that your first gig's on the hardest radio station to, you know, announce the call letters. And I remember Schuster going, WW, go up the ladder, go down the ladder. WW. I said, sort of a Don Imus,
yeah.
WNEW.
Yeah, or Howard Stern, WNBC.
Yeah, that's right, yeah, WNBC. Laying on the floor. Trying to do it like Don Imus with pig vomit.
Right.
Karen Civelli has such, and still does. And I want to this day, I just want to shake her because she's one of the best voiceover artists on the planet. She can read and sell it, and it sounds so good, and it's so natural. Mm-hmm. And she was so great on the air. So good. And she was always over-prepped. And I mean hopelessly over-prepped. Mm. She had stuff everywhere that she never used, but she brought it in every day.
Never know what you're going to need.
Guys would call and say, is she as good-looking as I think she is? And I'd go, yes. Yes, she is.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So,
that about that same time. So we got JJ, we got you in Middays, Arthur, and then Karen. That's when.
And then you started to have other little branches growing out of that that became really important parts of that radio station.
Such as?
Well, you had Lynn Woodison, who was doing news with JJ and George,
who later became your co-host.
Who later became my co-host. And Lynn, another one who, two things, had the same Freudian slip. She came with the same sort of credentials that Karen did. Mm. Very good sounding person. Very attractive.
Mm-hmm.
Very attractive. But just so talented. It's shocking to me that I worked with three of the greatest female talents I can ever imagine. Randy Stember, Karen Civelli and Lynn Whittison. Mm-hmm. You know, not to mention Rhonda Hart, the late great Rhonda Hart.
Rhonda was great.
Such a powerful person. And just so those branches started to grow. You had sports people coming in. Eli Zarrett started basically his career. In fact, he started, did his first ever radio sports cast with me at WAVX. And we played the Harlem Globetrotters theme song, worrying nothing at all about royalties or any of that.
Of course not.
Did it all the time. As did they with when he was sports with JJ and the morning crew. So you had, I mean, think of that. Think of that show.
Sure.
You know, you had Jim Johnson, George Boyer, Lynn Whittison, Eli Zarrett. And it was just phenomenal how good that show sounded.
Yes.
I mean, they had a good morning show.
Mm-hmm.
They had good news. They had great sports. They had great talent, great bits.
Mm-hmm.
And they had great music.
Right.
Fresh out of the fresh out of the plastic.
Well, and at that point, Riff had great marketing, which was kind of new to radio at the time.
That was ABC owned and operated.
Mm-hmm. Like the Remarkable Mouth TV commercial.
Well, Kelly Harmon, I'll never forget my Uncle Lindy saying to me, "I don't listen to that radio station, but I'm gonna because of that girl on the TV set. Do you know her? Do you work with her?" No, Uncle Lindy, I don't work with her. She came in once, and she's pretty. No, she lives out in Los Angeles.
Out in L.A., yeah.
But that was, yeah, so the joke was, if the ratings were down, ABC in New York would say, "How much do you need?"
And just throw on those TV spots, yeah.
Or throw you the money.
Mm.
I'll never forget, we got into a problem once. And I don't know. I remember when WLLZ launched. I want to say Lee Arnold was the PD. And he flew a helicopter and landed it on the property over at Lawrence Tech, right across from Channel 7 Broadcast House. And he got out of the helicopter and stood on a flatbed truck and megaphone. Kind of did a Steve Dahl disco demolition deal. And had the megaphone, "You want a piece of us? Well, we're going to come." And they did 98 straight days of commercial-free radio.
Which is very tough to compete against.
June, July, August, it was killing us.
Mm-hmm.
But we figured out and we knew exactly when the commercials were coming. And so we started a countdown on them.
Mm.
And then they had to really start to pay off some debt. So they went spot heavy. And we went spot light, and we did five in a row or we paid the dough. $5,000 if we don't play five.
I remember that.
We pay five. Now, $5,000, if you monetize it to today, would probably be what? $75,000,
$15,000? Yeah. Because we're talking 1981.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, but it would be 10 grand.
Mm-hmm, easy.
So that one, and everybody got their chance to do it. And I'll never, ever forget the time Costan blew it. And that was the only time I've ever seen Bender, and I forget who the PD was at the time.
Fred, maybe? Was it Fred?
No, Fred was the PD. Bender was not the... it doesn't really matter, but they were furious. Tell you what he did. He started to play "I Love Rock and Roll," and just that da 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 da, and then he went to spots. Guy called and said, "Nope, you did not fulfill the promise. Five in a row, or we pay the dough." And this guy was not going to go away. And he was right.
Yeah, concert tickets weren't going to make him go away.
Stevie hit the wrong button. Da 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 da, and it was like, you know, the beginning of Joan Jett.
Sure.
And there wasn't even a guitar lick. It might not have even been that much, but we had promised to play a song from start to finish, five in a row with no interruptions.
Yeah, promise is a promise.
Yeah. And I think we disqualified it with the fact that we might have some sort of imaging in between. Five in a row, or we pay the dough.
Mm.
You know, $5,000. You know, and sure enough, we all had our time assigned to us when we would get it. And it was like...
And it seems easy enough. You just play five. You're not going to do it by accident. Where like you, Steve
you
did,
wouldn't,
you know.
You wouldn't think so, would you? Yeah, wouldn't think so. And long story short on that one, too. He did, and that really kind of bummed out the game.
But I did, yeah. So you were doing middays for a long time, and then there were some changes at Riff. You moved to mornings. JJ moved to Wheels. Right?
JJ moved to Wheels, and that's when radio got weird. I didn't want to do mornings. I never wanted to do mornings, but everybody always considered me to be the most natural guy to do mornings if you didn't have mornings that were that good.
It's an interesting way of putting it.
In other words, I was the bullpen guy. You know, I was the guy that, like, boy, if you didn't have a great morning show, Ken Calvert would be a great morning show. You guys really got it good, because if anything ever happens to your morning show, you got Ken Calvert. Well, that's a nice feeling to have.
Sure.
It's not a nice feeling to have when the morning show that you have goes to a radio station that you compete with.
Right.
So the audience still has the morning radio show. Now you have to go
and earn a brand new audience.
And just for 2 months go, they're at WLOZ. Hi, Riff, they're at WLOZ. Hi, Riff, they're at WLOZ.
Yeah, that is rough.
So you try and eventually get some cred, but that was the hardest part. But there was a point where Lynn, TC, Sports Grunt, Fred McLeod, host of other characters, with yours truly.
And Joe Napoli was in there.
Well, at one point, that was not my doing, and I don't mean to ever say a bad word about Joe. That just didn't work. He brought too much energy and too much of his own personal direction that I was not into.
And he wasn't really a radio guy.
He was a comedian, and a damn good comedian. Mm-hmm. A damn good comedian. But he got way, way, way too involved. And he got to the point of nearly demanding that we do a bit with Sly Stallone. Demanding that we do a bit with Howard Cosell.
Mm.
He did a character that nobody understood, that a friend of his in L.A. had created, and he was the donut man, and it didn't work, it didn't make sense, and it drove me absolutely insane. And Lynn was working with us on and off again. She just decided to just do the news. I mean, he became that disruptive.
Yeah, she's kind of gave up.
She was no longer... She was like, I don't want to just do the news, I want to be a part of the show. No, at that particular time, she wanted to just do the news and let us have at it, because she knew it was getting just a little too freakish. The party was no longer a party.
And it didn't last long.
But it was weird, because Jim and George did not take Lynn. You know, it was always JJ and George. And that left... We had a point where Bob Page then, you know... Eli was doing TV, and Eli didn't have the room to do, you know, that anymore. So he decided, well, if you guys are going to WLOC, then I'm just going to go do my Channel 4 stuff, and Lynn will stay back, and Napoli, you know, it was just Lynn and I, but they insisted that I had to have a partner. So they didn't recruit me in the decision at all.
Wow.
In fact, they went to Mike Binder. Very good friend of mine.
Another comedian.
Detroit's own Mike Binder. Yeah, and he's now a very, very successful film director. You know, he cast Arthur.
In The Upside of Anger.
Yeah, Outside of Anger. Yeah. Or The Upside.
Upside of Anger. Yeah.
Yeah, so they went to Binder, and Binder said, I got a guy that might work, and his name is Joe Napoli. And I thought, why didn't you say Dave Coulier?
Right.
Dave Coulier is funny.
And you were rolling with all these guys, because you were spending a lot of time at the comedy
clubs. How about Bill
clubs.
Engvall? or Bill Engvall. How about Craig Shoemaker? You know, I mean, how about Jerry Seinfeld?
Right. How about Tim Allen?
How about Jim Carrey or Tim Allen?
Right.
And, well, yeah, absolutely. And they all would have done it. Mm. They all would have done it. So it was really, that became the toughest. That's when things, radio was still my passion and my joy, but that's when things started to get fragmented.
Yeah.
And it was, it no longer had the new car smell.
Right.
It now started to have that whiff of mileage on it. You know what I mean? Started to feel like I knew this business pretty well.
Yeah.
And I was seeing some dark sides to it. It was no longer the utopian, you know, cloud that I'd been on for 15 wonderful years. Mm-hmm. I started to see the dark side of it. And I started to just see things that really, you know, were just affecting everything. I mean, it was like ratings became so important.
It was money.
Personality.
It was ego.
Money. It was ego. Yeah. All of those things. It just got to be, the greed started to come into it.
Yeah.
You know? My home's bigger than your home. Mm-hmm. Sort of. And I don't mean that either. It's just, you know, it started to get to be where you fell out of touch with old, dear friends.
Mm-hmm. Oh, and you're competing against some of your
thank you.
Old, dear friends.
You were
yeah.
competitors. So it was difficult. It was difficult, and the only thing that I did that I loved that kept me on everybody's radar was the Pistons.
Yeah. Coming up.
Ladies and gentlemen, number four, Joe Dumars. And remember Dumars looking over at me, and when he get a bucket, I'd do the same thing. Looking at me. So finally, one day he comes over to check in when the players would check in, almost like college. Got his hand on the table. I said, "Hey, Joe, how you doing?" He goes, "Cool." I said, "Do you mind me doing that Dumars thing?" He goes, "I don't care." He said, "But my mom likes it. So as long as she likes it, keep doing it." I said, "Oh, okay."
BackstageCountry.com, your online home for all things country music. Like most of us, Keith Urban also has a bucket list. You may be surprised to learn what is and is not on his. Text Keith to 45911 to read and learn more about the central theme of Keith's bucket list. Get a link to the story sent right to your phone when you text Keith to 45911. Go inside country music at BackstageCountry.com.
The history of WRIF.
Ken Calvert, and a great opportunity for me to introduce you to my new best friend, Stevie Nicks, and I can also introduce you to her new single at the same time. It's called Secret Love, and Stevie, tell me a little bit about the song.
It's very old. It's the oldest song that I can remember writing after joining Fleetwood Mac.
Legendary personalities from Detroit's iconic WRIF.
Whatever it was, I never told anybody.
Can I pretend it was me?
You certainly can.
All right, well, thank you so
much. I could have been traveling through
yeah.
Detroit.
Yes.
And I could have run into you on the street.
I think you did.
And we could have had a visit.
Yes.
And I could have flown away the next night, and nobody uh-huh. would have ever known.
And I would have
and
said nothing.
And I would
nothing.
Have written the song. And
I
you would have said nothing because you would have been honorable.
No, I would have been in tears, though.
Right, you would have been in tears.
With Mike Staff and our special guest, Ken Calvert.
Now, you're with the Pistons, and you couldn't have picked a better time
oh.
to start doing that gig.
And that was never supposed to happen.
So let's just get our listeners up to speed. Ken was the Pistons PA announcer inside the Palace from 1986 to 2002.
Yes.
And how did you get that job? That's an interesting
very strange.
Job to get.
Very, very strange. I used to go out to the games, the Pontiac Silverdome, with a couple of buddies. Mike Mayer was one of them. It was just easy. It was just an easy thing to do. So we would go out there, and there was a guy by the name of Gary May. And Gary May was doing the Pistons. And they had the big blue curtain up. And they had the main event.
Right.
And they did it all wrong. You know, the main event was on the side where the curtain was up. So if you started at the main event...
Couldn't see the game.
Yeah. Have a couple of cocktails. And then you'd walk over and sit down. And then they had all these little stands where you could go down on the floor, bare floor, around the basketball court. And then they had another set of stands directly across from the mounted stands in the Pontiac Silverdome. So Gary May's doing the games. And he's like, Detroit ball out of bounds. And I was like, and I turned to Mayor or Buzz Van Houten and I go, Detroit ball out of bounds.
Mocking him.
So I got to know a couple of the guys on the table because they were fans of the radio show. And when I'd go down for to get a beer or whatever, and the ushers were always, hey, Kenny Calvert, how you doing, bro? Nice to see you, man. Love the show. Thank you. Yeah, how are you? Bam. Firing the guns. You bet, man. So I go down, and somehow, some way, I run into Gary May. I always ran into Gary May after the games at the main event. And so he's sitting up there, and I did my impersonation of Gary May. And I had a couple of cocktails. I said, hey, I'm going to do my impersonation of you. Are you ready for this? Ladies and gentlemen, at this time, I'd like to ask you to please rise and join us in honoring America as Dr. Tim Coldiron performs God Bless America. And he goes, hey, that's pretty damn good. So, well, thank you. So he calls me up a few months later, and he said, hey, listen, I coach Berkeley football, and the Pistons have an exhibition season. I can't do the games. And he said, well, I can do a few, but I can't do all of them. You want to fill in? I said, no. Hell no, dude. I said, I get it, but I don't know. I'm not going to. He said, Alex, it's a no-brainer. You sit beside two guys who tell you everything. You just say what they tell you. He said, can't screw it up. It's only exhibition. So we were playing at Central Michigan, playing at St. John's in Windsor, or St. John, I don't even remember. I was like, man, I got to drive. He didn't want to drive to all these gigs. That was the deal. Played at the University of Toledo. Played at Eastern. And now, of course, you know, they play in their own building, as we did later on. So, did a couple of exhibition games. Then I had to do a couple of real games for him because of the fact that Berkeley got into the playoffs. And so I was like, okay. So Matt Dobek, who was the public relations director, comes over and he's like, where'd you come from? I said, don't ask me, I'm filling in for Gary May. Well, it would have been nice if somebody asked me. And he was a tough SOB. So anyway, all of a sudden I fill in another game. He goes, how you doing? I said, I'm good. Are you all right? He goes, yeah, I'm fine. You're fine. So I ended up doing about eight games that year. It was the year they drafted Dumars. So I always thought Lou Whitaker at Tiger Games, people, Lou. And Al Kaline, George Swell would say, you know, George Kell. I'd say, now they're not booing, you know. It was like Lou Pinella in New York.
Right. Sounded like they were booing.
They're saying Lou.
Lou, sweet Lou.
Oh, well, this guy's a rookie. He's a guard. When I go, do Mars. When, you know, when he's bringing the ball up the backcourt, let him go. Let him, you know, that's what I was trying to create.
Right.
Making the game about me. It's got to be about Ken. You had to be a big shot, didn't you? And so I was like, so then whenever he would come into the game, I'd go, you know, ladies and gentlemen, number four, Joe Dumars. And I remember Dumars looking over at me, and when he'd get a bucket, I'd do the same thing, looking at me, looking at me, looking at me, looking at me. So finally one day he comes over to check in when the players would check in, almost like college basketball. And he's got his hand on the table. I said, hey, Joe, how you doing? He goes, cool. I said, do you mind me doing that Dumars thing? He goes, I don't care. He said, but my mom likes it. So as long as she likes it, keep doing it. I said, oh, okay. The end of that season, Dobek calls me. Calvert, yeah, it's Dobek. I said, hey, what's up, Matt? Well, I got a problem. I said, what? He goes, I'm firing Gary May. I said, why? He goes, because I'm firing him. You don't have to know why. And I said, and I'm hiring you. I said, well, I don't want the job. Well, it doesn't matter. I'm firing him anyway. I said, okay, great. Well, you got to take the gig. You got to take it. I said, yeah. Okay, I mean, let me think about it. Don't take long. And I started thinking about it, and people said, oh, dude, don't be a fool. That'd be awesome. Do that. You know? And so I thought, yeah, I'll do it. So I started at the Silverdome. The 63,480 people. That was pretty cool.
Well, and the Pistons were just heating up at this point, too.
Heating up like you read about, yeah.
Right.
Just traded for Lame Beer, you know? And then they end up getting Ricky Mahorn, because I hated him. Hated him as a Bullet, now Wizards. We hated that big fat ass, man. People just wouldn't scream at him from the table.
He fit in with the bad boys, though, man.
Oh, man, did we adore him. Ricky. So anyway, I ended up doing that for 16 years. I got two rings out of the deal.
And you got the rings?
I did get the rings. And people say, I get on an airplane, people go, what did you, does your dad own the team? Now they go, what, do you own a team or something? Uh-huh. You know, or, what the hell college is that? Because they're so big now. Jeez.
Yeah.
But, so to say, the, I mean, 89, 90, 90, 91, just.
Great years.
God, we had a ball.
So when you were doing the Joe Dumars thing,
yeah,
most other PA announcers and other teams were just kind of doing the boring.
Yeah. None of the hip hop had arrived yet,
so they didn't know what to think when you were doing Joe Dumars,
like,
and
no,
they didn't like you.
And
anywhere.
Then the guy Ray Clay in Chicago decided Ray Clay. He was a radio guy too, but he was more one of those guys, ladies and gentlemen. And he went into a register that I couldn't stand. Your Chicago Bulls, you know, with the Alan Parsons Project music.
Right. You know,
and I thought the Final Countdown kicked everybody's ass. Mm-hmm. I mean, Pete Scorch, you got it, baby. Mm-hmm. Peter, you nailed it, you know. And I'll never forget, man, Dick Stockton, National TV. We throw it to our play-by-play announcer, or to our PA announcer, Mr. Ken Calvert. Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome. And I was like, breathe, Ken. Breathe. 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 It's only national TV. After that thing was over, somebody said, it's up on YouTube. I said, I can't watch it. I didn't watch it until probably 10 years ago.
Wow.
Yeah.
Isn't that something?
So, but yeah, so that got me out of my funk about where radio was going, because I was in kind of a funk.
And you had something new, and it's very exciting. So, and was that hard? I mean, there's 41 home games, right?
It was hard. Yeah, it wore you out.
And you were doing mornings for part of that. So
for a long time.
That's really tough.
So that was a great turnaround. I slept 4 in the morning, 4 at night, 4 in the morning. Yeah, I was never so glad for him to go to the West Coast.
Right.
That was when life, you kind of resettled. And then all of a sudden, I went to LLZ, the most money I ever made in my life. And within a year and a couple of months of that contract, CBS sold the radio station.
Sold wheels.
Flipped it to Jazz. Said, you don't have to come in. You can if you want. We'll give you an office. Otherwise, you just stay home and collect your money.
For the remainder of your contract.
Yeah, but we got a non-compete on you. That you cannot work.
Mm.
So JR came after me, oddly enough. It's when J.P. McCarthy died. J.P. McCarthy, they had me fill in for J.P. McCarthy. And I did really well. And it was like, I was actually considered for that gig.
That was after J.P. McCarthy died.
After he died.
Yeah.
Directly after he died.
Okay.
Yeah.
You were the next
Jimmy
one.
Jimmy Lance was filling in. Mm-hmm. A few other guys. We kind of rotated in the morning. And we did it in spite of the wheels. They didn't care.
Yeah.
It was not in their wheelhouse.
Yeah.
It was like, go ahead and do it. And then nothing opened up after I did JR for a few, I'd say a year of just, and they offered me a gig. They offered me a gig, and I never really felt comfortable in that at all. I loved it. I liked it. But I just felt like something was, that really, you know, wasn't where I wanted to
be.
And so I, luckily for me, I won the money lottery again. Dr. Laura insisted on my day part, which was 12 to 3. She was on at night. She insisted upon it. So they wanted to move me into this and create this and create that. And I said, why don't I just go away? Why don't you guys just, you know, why don't we just, I'll take the dough. And they were like, really? And I said, yeah. And So I just was on the streets because, you know, with Wheels and JR, and I did some ancillary work for the Palace. I was just kind of helping them out in media, you know, doing stuff. Yeah. And I, as it turned out, we were doing a thing. We were looking for opening acts, comedy acts, which we were going to partner with Mark Ridley's Comedy Castle for Pine Knob. And I was just going to radio stations and talking about what we were trying to do. And people said, what are you doing now? Went to CSX. I was on with JJ and Lynn.
And as a guest on the morning show.
Yep. I called them up and said, can I come on as a guest? And they said, sure. Came on, and 2 months later, it happened again, and that's where I worked for 16 years, and that's where it all came to an end.
And that was your longest stint at any
radio station. It was, 16 years. Yep, it sure was, and I loved it. Mm-hmm. Absolutely loved it. And I never, ever thought I'd have to, you know, pull up and not be able to go into the building.
Right. Isn't that weird?
Yeah, I never thought that would happen.
Well, it changes all over again.
Yeah, but I was, you know, I kind of termed out, I think. And now I'm doing like so many other people are. Although I'm not good at it because I'm not disciplined enough. I've got OCD really bad, ADD, whatever it is. I start something and then I get into it and I kind of let another thing
get in your way. Yeah.
Yeah, it kind of like it can sit there for a while. But I decided this week the Ken Calvert Show podcast is going back up.
Oh, good.
We haven't posted anything for about a month.
Because you've done quite a few podcasts.
Yeah. And so that'll go back up. I just found a ton of more stuff. I just found it. And once when I find something, then I go on a mission to find more. Mm. I go on a mission, and I went on that mission, and that mission was into the basement, and by God, I found it.
Some old good tapes.
I did find a ton of dats, and I got some good stuff. So I got to just say, and you know what else I got to do, Mike? I got to just sit down and feel comfortable opening the mic and just telling people what the hell I think.
Right.
Because I drive around, and I'm thinking about stuff all the time, and I think it's funny. I think it's observational. Nobody gets hurt. No one will ever know where I am politically. You know, people that say opinions are mine, whatever, I have no interest in going there. You know, you will never, ever follow me into a voting booth, right. And you'll never, ever follow me out. And if you'd like to, you can, but I'll just hand you your I voted sticker, but that's all you're going to get from me.
Coming up.
He never, ever said baby. He said A-B. Okay, now think about this. Rock and roll. Good afternoon, everybody. It's me, Arthur P. Rock and roll. Hey, buddy. Did you hear a B in that? Did anybody hear a B?
The History of WRIF. The podcast is brought to you by the Specs Howard School of Media Arts.
BackstageCountry.com, your online home for all things country music. Like most of us, Keith Urban also has a bucket list. You may be surprised to learn what is and is not on his. Text Keith to 45911 to read and learn more about the central theme of Keith's bucket list. Get a link to the story sent right to your phone when you text Keith to 45911. Go inside country music at BackstageCountry.com.
Legendary personalities from Detroit's iconic WRIF with Mike Staff and our special guest Ken Calvert.
So, Ken, looking back, what era do you feel like you were most in your zone? That you're most like you were there? You were right.
I'll give you a year.
1983.
Mm-hmm. 1983. I was still in my 20s. My body was working right. I had so much energy, so much passion. I had so many great friends that are still my great friends. And there was not a reason to be angry about anything. Mm-hmm. I would, if I could, when I die, I'm going to say, look, I know we'll get there, okay? I had a chance to see my mom and dad, okay? I saw them. It was great. And they're busy as it is. I knew they would be. Can I go back to 83 for just about 15 minutes? Can I do that? Okay, do I just stand here? What happens?
Wouldn't that be cool?
Okay. One, two, three. Poof. Yeah. Anybody seen Arthur? Is he going to be on time? Somebody on the hallway said he called. He's not. He's going to be late. Is that true?
Arthur has always said you were the absolute best midday host that ever lived in any radio station anywhere, that you were just born for the role.
Well, we can end with this if you'd like. He was the best man at my wedding, and he had so much fun at the bachelor party. There was some great concern that he may not make the wedding, but he made it.
Of course.
But he was supposed to help with a lot of different things early that morning. That didn't happen.
They have the best man responsibilities.
And finally, I want you to realize and think very hard about this. He never, ever said baby. He said A-B. Okay, now think about this. Rock and roll. Good afternoon, everybody. It's me, Arthur P. Rock and roll. Bye-bye. Did you hear a B in that? Did anybody hear a B?
That's true.
Rock and roll. Bye-bye.
Ken, thank you. My absolute pleasure.
I had a B-A-double-L with a capital B.
Absolutely. Thank you.
101 FM, WRIF. Hey, buddy. Take that, Arthur.
BackstageCountry.com, your online home for all things country music. Like most fans of country music, we're excited to learn that Luke Combs was back in the studio working on his next album. We've come up with our list of iconic Luke Combs music videos. Yes, Lovin' On You made the cut. Text Luke to 45911 to see if your favorite made the list on BackstageCountry.com. Text Luke to 45911 and we'll send the link straight to your phone.